Welcome back to Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson and here at the Southern Arizona Horse Expo. Of course, what a great piece that we just had with Alan Martin. And in front of me, of course, is his painting because, lo and behold, I've got another gentleman with me that we're going to talk to because his horse is memorialized actually on this show, this piece of artwork as well. So welcome to the show, Bill Mooney.
Well, thank you.
Great. It's a pleasure to have you there. Let me just give a very brief introduction. Bill, of course, has been on our show before. We did a really fun segment called Ride Tall with a Loose Rein, which is a moniker for Bill. He gives advice to all of us. Bill is truly a celebrated artist as well of the Southwest, internationally recognized as a painter, sculptor, and designer whose art is represented in over 15 countries. Bill's award-winning works are exhibited in museums and private collections, including several commissioned portraits and bronze sculptures, landscapes, wildlife, cowboy characters, you name it. Bill pursued his passion of the fine arts at the University of Nebraska, where he also played football and ran track. And by the way, he went on to become an Olympic silver medal winner. He also then taught and took drawing and painting at the Denver Art Academy. He's a writer, book illustrator, and lifelong storyteller, as I'm sure you're going to find out in the course of our conversation. He's also known for his love and passion with his wife, Sandy, who are very well known for raising some of our nation's most celebrated American quarter horses. That would be the lineage of Coy's Bonanza. A horse described as having the look of an eagle, and when you set him up, looking like he is trying to see over the next hill. So during this time frame, Bill was president of an international design, new product development firm, and chairman of the world-renowned Milwaukee Zoo. So Coy's Bonanza, and here it is right on Alan's painting. Tell us about your horse.
Well, my horse was a rare horse. Of course, everybody thinks his own horse is the best, but I knew Bill Coy and I were good friends. He lived in Torrington, Wyoming. We rodeoed, and he owned Coy's mother. And another good friend of mine in Denver owned the sire, Jaguar. So we talked Bill into breeding the mare to Jaguar, and the result was Coy's Bonanza. He wasn't named that, but Bill tells the story that when he first saw the foal, he ran to the house and said, "Mom, we've struck a bonanza." So therefore, Coy's Bonanza is how he got his name. Bill worked for Jack Casement, who is one of the founders of the Quarter Horse Association and registry. And Bill had access and owned probably the best horses in the world, but Bill always needed money and he always had to sell them. So he never actually ended up with any good horses. But he took Coy's Bonanza, at that time as a two-year-old, down to the Denver sale because they needed the money. And at that time, I didn't have the money to buy him. I wanted the horse. And a fellow by the name of Ed Coppola from Iowa bought the horse, and I kind of kept track of where he went, and I knew his trainer, Dean Landers. And so I said, "Dean, let me know if he ever wants to get rid of the horse." He said, "Well, he will. He was a car dealer. He wasn't a horse guy." And he said, "Eventually he'll tire of this." So Dean called me one day and said he's still interested in the horse, and I flew over and dealt with Ed and bought Coy's Bonanza. And then we later put him on the racetrack. I put him with one of the leading trainers in the country now. At that time, he was a basketball coach, Wayne Lucas, who's
Don't
won the Kentucky
it.
Derby
yes,
and
there you
many,
go.
Many other shows. And Wayne, we raced him at Centennial and then later down south, and got him as he was a AAA horse on the racetrack. And of course he was National High Point horse as a show horse. And so I put him at stud. And I remember from back in 1941, when the Quarter Horse Association was founded, and I saw a horse by the name of King. He was P234 by number. And everybody wanted a king-bred horse at that time. And I used to think, gosh, what if you owned all the mares and you had the market? And so that's what I did with Coy's Bonanza. I didn't breed him to outside mares.
Okay.
I had 40 mares of my own that I had collected. And so if you wanted to buy a Bonanza, you had to come to me, which was kind of nice. And it was like clipping coupons, if you will. You know, I had a waiting list for people who wanted to buy a foal.
And I think the number you told me once was 240 foals?
I don't recall. I told you that.
But some extraordinary number, folks. Yeah. That's right.
And it was a nice experience because I got to meet everybody that owned one, and we became kind of a happy family.
Well, in fact, here at the Expo, folks, right before Bill came on, he's been wandering around looking at the exhibits and reconnecting with a variety of horses. And you said you ran into somebody you knew from Nebraska.
Yeah, from Ainsworth.
And, isn't that funny?
He's in there demonstrating now on how to break a yearling. And it's a small world. I remember back in 41, my dad said, I wanted to join the association. It was just newly founded. Bob Denhart, who is a graduate student, put together all the paperwork for the association, and they decided at that time that they were dickering for who was going to be the first horse ever registered, and they finally decided the stallion that won the Fort Worth Fat Stock Show it was a horse by the name of Wimpy, and so the evolution has been fantastic from then to now. Exactly. My dad discouraged me. He said, why would you ever want to join? They'll be out of business in 2 years. He said, take a look at the horse. Because my dad liked those old remount horses, which had a lot more leg under them. And quarter horse at that time was 14-2 and kind of bulldog type. And so I didn't join the association for a few years. And now I look back and think, dummy.
Well, but, you know, it's like I said when we were there with Alan, is that when somebody gives us advice, they're 50% talking to themselves. So even our dad and our mom, we kind of have to still hold ourselves accountable to put a lens on it.
Well, now your mom is backstage.
I know.
So you have to be
don't
very
tell
careful.
Her that exactly. I'll know that one will come around to get me, won't it, though? Well, Bill, as always, the storyteller that you are, it's wonderful. I learn something every time we get a chance to get connected, and thanks for enlightening our listeners. Again, I have my guest here today is Bill Mumy. One of the subjects you wanted to talk about and also illustrate another facet of your incredible and broad career in the movie and film side is the movie that you did, On the Fifth Day.
Oh, yeah.
What was the inspiration behind your deciding to do that?
Well, at that time, I was heading up the they call it the Public Information Committee for the AQHA in Amarillo. It's really the marketing and advertising and so forth. And I thought one tool would be a motion picture on the history of the quarter horse. And the Quarter Horse Association, of course, distributed this, and it's been very popular because I started with the origin of the horse, which was North America. A small little rodent-like animal called the condylarth.
And it was 14 inches.
Yeah, right, 14 inches tall, and it had three toes, and it was the father, if you will, of all odd-toed creature, where you have the camel and the rhino, and you don't associate those with horses, but they actually were. In fact, the first horses, from an evolutionary standpoint, had three toes, and over a period of time, through the Merychippus and the Merychippus and so forth, up until it became the equus, the side toes shrank and it left one central digit, which we call the hoof today. And the equus was probably closer to our modern day horse than anything. And it all took place in this country. And then they migrated over the land bridges into Europe and Asia. And then when the Bering Sea separated the continents and Straits of Gibraltar, what was there was there, and what was here. And for some reason, some 2,000 years ago, the horse became extinct in this country. Nobody knows why, pestilence, famine, whatever. So for 2,000 years, we didn't have a horse in this country. And the Indians, the indigenous people, had no idea that there was such a creature. So when Cortez, in 1519, came into Veracruz, the Aztecs had never seen this thing that was coming ashore with the armor and the helmet riding this animal that they'd never seen. They threw down their arms and considered them a god. And otherwise, Cortez would have been their lunch because
they were
cannibalistic by nature. And then in 1520, Admiral Pedro Mendez landed in which is now Florida. It was called Spanish Gaul at the time, with another type of horse. And these horses were finely bred horses, the Andalusians and the Spanish Barb, the Mongolian War Horse, and the Dulman horses in from Germany. So they because all of the horse was really developed in Europe, and all came from this same equus, but the development of the horse was at this point environmental.
Okay, yeah.
In the grasslands of England and Ireland, they became bigger, and they developed into a breed that we now think of as Clydesdales, or
of course,
or you know, the workhorses. And in the Middle East, where there was sand and so forth, the Arab horse developed. He was a finer, small-boned horse.
And built for the endurance of going
built
through the heat.
Built for the endurance, yeah. Yes. They win all the endurance contests. And so it was a mixture that all stemmed from the original equus. So when they brought some of those horses into this country, a lot of them escaped, mm-hmm. ran wild. And so now you've got a bunch of horses out there that were finely bred horses, your Andalusians and your Mongolian horses and so forth, that were not equipped to handle this kind of harsh environment. They'd always been pampered horses.
Sure.
And well bred. So a lot of them died off. They weren't immune to some of the diseases. And the ones that lived became very tough horses. They were kind of nondescript horses because you could have a Percheron bred to an Arab, and then they would breed to another conglomeration. And so it was Indians called them Mustangs, wild horses. But they were of no breed, and they have no breed consistency because they're a little of everything. Mm-hmm. And when the pioneers brought the horses from the East.
East, right.
And developed the quarter mile horse, the racing horse, which they called at that time the quarter mile pathers.
Pathers, exactly. Love it.
And they started breeding some of their horses to the Mustangs to get that endurance and then try to build up the conformation. Anyway, I'm giving you the whole history right here.
Well, no, but this is really the retelling, and I think, again, for our listeners, and certainly reflective of our event here today, that this expo is about all breeds, all versions,
yes.
all uses of the horse, both as stock horses for the cowboys that need them to do their work,
yes.
those who enjoy the fun and spirit of racing, and then the pleasure riders and those who like to show their horses.
Yes.
I mean, that's what this broader community is about, so the history is so foundational to it.
Well, Philip II was the first to establish different kinds of horses for different usages. The Hittites were the first to domesticate a horse, but they just used him as a work animal. But Philip II recognized that the bigger horses he used for armored warfare, because the guys with the armor were
sure.
very heavy
right.
and had lances. It was a jousting kind of thing. And the smaller boned horses, the Arab-type horses, he used for reconnaissance because they could go forever, very agile. And then the middle of the road horses used for one-on-one combat. So they were the tanks and the
right.
infantry.
And the F-16s
so
and the
yes.
whatever.
Yeah. And so we're carrying that on here. Of course, as you say, this fair or clinic, whatever,
yes.
I don't know what you call
combination.
It.
Combination.
Is a wonderful thing because it demonstrates what Philip II recognized many, many years ago, that you have different horses for different usages. Each breed thinks his horse is the best.
The best, that's right. Well, right before the show, I wandered over and you were chatting with some people and talking because you noticed here on Alan Martin's painting the reference to Appaloosa, and you've got quite a connection with the Appaloosa. Can you tell us that story real
well,
quick?
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, that's a breed now, of
yeah.
course, and there are various kinds of breeds. Like the Mustang could never be a breed because he's a little of everything,
right.
you know. But there are some breeds that are strictly color breeds. The Appaloosa happened to be one. It had the funny-looking blanket and the speckles. Some of them were what they call leopard. And the Palomino is a breed, but it's strictly a color. You can have a draft horse, And originally, when the Palomino registry began, they said two shades either darker or lighter than a freshly minted gold coin.
Don't you love it? I love it. The elocution of that.
Yeah, if they met that standard, they could be registered. Where other breeds, like the quarter horse and the thoroughbred and so forth, are breeds of confirmation. They have to, of course, they have some color barriers too. With a quarter horse, you can't have white above the knee, or you can't have white beyond the corner of the mouth, that kind of thing. But basically, they're so the Appaloosa was kind of the throwback of the early Mongolian horses. And if you look at the old Ming Dynasty sculptures and paintings, you'll see this speckled horse. And it's the only place you ever see it. So years later, when the Mustangs were breeding to different breeds, the ones that carried that characteristic still kept that speckled look. And this was right after the war, and I had a number of Appaloosa horses. We used them as clown horses because they were kind
the rodeo,
of funny,
yep, funny
looking. And the guy from Palouse, Idaho, George Hatley, I was living in Denver at the time, drove over and he said, I know you have a lot of Appaloosas. And he said, I'm thinking of starting an Appaloosa Association and a registry. And I kidded him. I said, George, take another look. They're ugly, you know, which they were. They had no tail and very little mane and jug heads and just from a lot of inbreeding. And he said, no, I think we can develop a story around the Nez Perce Indian, who was the only Indian to practice selective breeding.
Yep, breeding of Appaloosa.
And I said, is that true, George? He says, I don't know, but it's...
It makes a great story.
A great story.
We're going to spin a brand up right away.
Yeah. Well, now, today, the horse has developed, and they've really worked on their confirmation. It's a wonderful horse. So, and there are other breeds that have developed in similar manners.
Well, real quick about the movie that obviously portrays the story. You just were nice enough to recap most of it to us here today. You had Lauren Green from Bonanza television fame narrate the movie. You actually did all the writing, producing, directing, and a lot of the filming yourself.
Yeah.
That was an interesting phase of your life that you tapped
Well,
all
I had
resources.
Been filming wildlife for Disney
for
quite some time. And so it was a kind of a natural progression. And the association needed something in an educational film. And the first guy I used to narrate the film was Gary Merrill. I don't know if you remember him. Gary was married to Betty Davis at the time. And Gary was a very famous movie actor. And when he finished, it was awful.
Oh, dear.
I mean, he just didn't have that feel. I didn't know what to do. And so I just took a chance and called Lauren Green. Because he was the voice of Doom.
Oh, yeah,
in
there you go.
Canada.
Right.
And I told him what the project was, but I said, Lauren, I got to tell you, I didn't tell him I'd used Gary. I said, I've blown my budget. And so he said, what is it? And I said, well, I told him what the story was and so forth. He said, I'll do it. So when he first did the first line of the movie.
He knew it.
It was fantastic. It ran chills up your back because they used a quote out of the Bible.
Yes.
And
on the fifth day.
Yeah, exactly. It was morning of the fifth day, and God said, let there bring forth all creatures, each to his own kind.
In fact, this was overlaid, of course, with the visual of your filming the birth of a young one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah. So anyway, that's the story of the film. A horse is a fascinating animal. I wish I could see more of the clinic because... the guys that work with them every day know it. And I was kind of interested in the fellow, this trainer that's in there now, said, he's training a young horse, and he said, I treat them like they were a loaded gun.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, how true. Because I've always said, I've lived with horses all my life, and I've spent thousands of miles hauling horses, and I've always treated them like they would hurt me.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't understand that. There's so many mythological stories about horses, and Zane Grey and made heroes out of horses. And they aren't. They're a horse. If you ever watch the show Dog Whisperer, you see, we treat our dog like family, and he's a rotten dog. You treat him like a dog, and you treat a horse like a horse, and they will hurt you.
I think there's another piece of it, too. Of course, I'm not nearly the equestrian that you are, but, of course, the horses reflect you and where you are. And that if you've got anything there in your own psyche and your body language or whatever that you're not conscious of, that that can evoke a reaction and cause some chain of events that really, you know, you're not in control of. You need to be cautious and aware.
Well, they're a big animal. If they realized that they what they could get away with, there'd be no way you could get on their back and ride them.
Isn't that the truth? Now, I'm starting to think about, Jesus, is there some message there for those of us that are parents with our young kids?
Yeah,
are they a little bit low? Yeah, they know how to get us, don't they at all? Bill, this phase of your career and your life then, we want to, of course, recognize and touch on your ongoing love and passion for painting and sculpting. What are you working on right now this week in your studio?
Well, since I came, I, of course, lived in Colorado for a lot of my adult life, and I was doing anything and everything, and I did a lot of African things because I've been going to Africa for years. Matter of fact, the first trip I took to Africa, I went to make a film back in 50, and when I moved out here, galleries had two cowboys and Indians. I mean, that's what they wanted, so I've been doing cowboys and Indians. Of course, growing up in that kind of life, it was easy for me, but it was kind of mandatory too. So you can say, well, it's for the love of the way of life, and I could create a story around that. But it was really a fact that this is what people expected.
Yeah.
So I'm doing right now two other size, life size and a half mountain lions for a new shopping center up in Oro Valley, and I've completed the bronzes. Now I'm going to be working on the rocks and the waterfall and so forth.
And of course, there's a real legacy of mountain lions in your background because you used to do that work for Disney, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, I shot all the mountain lion footage for Vanishing Prairie,
yes,
a movie.
Beautiful.
So, well, there's a good example. I raised mountain lions because I had some tame ones that I'd raised. I could throw them in the back of my car and lead them around, took them to school.
Okay, talk about loaded horses.
Yeah.
Let's talk about mountain lions,
well, that's,
right?
Well, that's my point.
That's your point.
One day I was cleaning out. I had some big chain link, I say cages, but they were really big. And Noble was one of the lions that I used for the films. He was laying asleep in the corner, and I'm sweeping out. When I turned to sweep the debris out of the cage, bang, he hit me in the back.
Wow.
And of course, it startled me, and I started to struggle. And he had my neck in his mouth, and of course, had me by the shoulders. And the more I struggled, the tighter it got. And I stopped and was quiet and talked to him. And he finally just got down, went back, and went to sleep. But the point is that even though I'd raised him and he was my child, he could have killed me easily at that moment, because he's a wild animal.
He's a wild animal.
And horses are the same.
Exactly. Well, Bill Mumy, thank you so much for joining us here on the show today. I want to again encourage our listeners, and we're going to cut him loose so he can go and enjoy some of the clinics and probably reconnect with some other friends. The continued contributions you make to the art world, to the literary world with your writing, to your presence and joining us here on the show, I really greatly appreciate it. And thanks so much for giving us your time.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
That's great. My pleasure. Stay tuned with us, folks. And we're out here at the bottom of the hour. We're going to catch some quick news. And then welcome next up on deck will be Mr. Michael Blake, our celebrated screenwriter who wrote Dances with Wolves and also an equestrian himself. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be right back here on Circles of Change.